Okay. I always choose this topic to learn before Shabbat Zachor, because inevitably, people ask, what is this idea of Machot Timche et Zecher Amalek, and wiping out every man, woman, and child? That definitely does not sound like the morality of the Torah that we're accustomed to. And it's a good opportunity to deal with a lot of mitzvot which seem outdated or which seem immoral. And I'm sure everybody here has their list of mitzvot which they find difficult. Some people ask about avadim. How could the Torah allow slavery? Right? We all today know that slavery is wrong. And how does the Torah allow it? The same thing with polygamy. Why does the Torah allow to have many different wives, to get married at a young age, to marry off children, even young children? Eshet Yifat Toar, right? Taking the enemy's wives on the battlefield, even if she's a married woman, right? That doesn't sound like Jewish morality. Sometimes there are mitzvot which sound even self-defeating. For example, Shemitah Ksafim, for example. You all know that the idea is every 7 years, whatever money you lent out to the poor people, they don't have to pay back. You all heard of Shemitah Ksafim. Now, what's the idea? The idea is to help the poor people get a new start on life. You know, they took all of these loans and they dug themselves into a ditch, and now they can't get out. The problem was that people stopped lending money to the poor people. So they had 7 difficult years. And if so, what, the Torah didn't know about that? So today we have different heterim that we use, you know, to sell chametz to the goy. You know, it seems like a loophole. Or the heter iska, to allow you to take interest from a Jew, from a bank. Or for Shemitah, right? The pruzbul. You all know what a pruzbul is? That allows you to take the money back from the poor person who you lent to it on the 7th year. In other words, what's going on here? These loopholes sound like the Torah is lacking eternity. Do you all see that? These are big questions. Thinking of a question to ask. Mm-hmm. we'll try and ask all of them. Chiyuv mita, right? The idea of capital punishment. Most modern countries today don't put anybody to death. And there we see in the Torah, there's skila, sreifa, hereg, cheneg, you're put to death for here, put to death for that. Now, I'll already answer this one parenthetically, that anybody who's learned Masechet Sanhedrin knows that the death penalty was never really carried out. It says that a Beit Din that puts somebody to death even once every 70 years is called a bloody Beit Din. Because if you learn the laws of capital punishment, to have 2 kosher witnesses giving proper warning, it's almost undoable. And if so, the idea of capital punishment is like a deterrent, you know. The Torah is saying, this is really serious business. But Amalek, we mentioned, right? It doesn't sound like a very moral mitzvah. Conquering the land of Israel. Even conquering the land of Israel, which today, you know, the United Nations say, what about the Palestinians? You know, they were here, and how could you conquer the land of Israel? And the Torah tells us it's a mitzvah. Well, Sefer Yoshua is conquering the land of Israel. So that also we have to understand. Other people will ask on women's issues. Things like, there are a lot of laws for women that seems like women have a lower hand in halacha. Right? The idea of agunah. Right, that if the husband disappears or a husband doesn't give a get, the wife is messed up for life. Or she might have to pay money. Or women are not kosher to be witnesses. Right? Or bichlal, even a bracha. I know women who have difficulty with the bracha of she asani kiritsono or she lo asani isha. Right? And sorry, you're taking all these down. There are a lot of questions. There are a lot of questions, right? Okay. Right? Well, that's what we're going to talk about. One of the things, I don't know if we'll get there this week, but next week in honor of Shabbat Zachor, for sure we'll get there.
When is Shabbos or Shabbat Zachor?
Next week. Next Shabbat. And even something like kitniyot. Good question. Kitniyot. You all know what kitniyot are?
Yeah.
Right? So it just so happens that half of the girls here are Sephardi. Right? But you know, in America, most of the Jews are Ashkenazim. In Israel, most of the Jews are Sephardim. And the issue, you go to your in-laws, can you eat? What can't you eat? The idea of kitniyot, and you all know that most of the reason why Jews stayed away from kitniyot really doesn't apply that much anymore. And making medicine, taking medicine. A lot of Bali Tshuva have difficulty with the idea that you're not allowed to take medicine on Shabbat. Do you know that? If you're sick, you could take medicine. But say you just have a little headache. Why are you not allowed to take medicine? Anybody know? Yeah?
Because they used to grind it.
Right. Because they used to grind the herbs together. And girls, has anybody ever ground their own medicine?
No.
We don't grind our medicine anymore. And if so, apparently it's a pain in the neck, or a pain in the tooth, or a pain in the wherever your pain is, and you can't take a painkiller on Shabbat unless you're sick. And the question is it not time to update a lot of things in Judaism? And I obviously chose the most juicy topics and questions. Yeah?
Can I ask a question on that?
Sure.
Question. But, like, if you start to update, like, the Torah, then where does it end?
Oh, fantastic.
Like, maybe
right?
That's why you can't, like, change it with time, because, like...
That's a good question, but the answer is very simple. And that's what we're going to talk about. One last word of introduction. Chevra, we are not Reform, obviously. And like Rabbanit El Yishmereni points out, if we start making changes, you know, we're going to end up throwing out the baby with the bathwater, right? Even Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof knew, you know, tradition. And I'll just share a quick mashal. The Dubna Magid, he was famous for his parables. He gave a parable of a small town in Europe. It's always a small town in Europe, Eastern Europe, where they had a hachnasat sefer Torah. And they wanted to get everybody involved, so they made candy bags for the children, and they had a competition among the women to embroider a covering for the sefer Torah. And on the day of the Achnasat Sefer Torah, they decided they have a competition, and judges will choose, and the nicest embroidered covering, that will be chosen. It's called a Torah mantle.
Torah what?
Mantle. That's Yiddish.
That's my Hebrew name.
Yeah?
Emma Mantle.
Mantle Esther.
Oh, mantle. And we're talking about mantle.
Oh.
But you're down in history. And the, so to make a long story short, an old widow, it's always an old widow, right? She won the competition, right? Her embroidered Torah mantle was chosen, and it was the happiest day of her life. And they invited her to put her covering on the Sefer Torah, and she was short, old, and she couldn't reach. So they helped her, and they had to tug a little. Tug here and tug there. It wasn't a good fit. And it really wasn't a good fit because they finally pulled it down and they saw that she had a terrible mistake in the measurements of the covering. And her Torah mantle covered just 2/3 of the Sefer Torah. And the happiest day of her life turned into the most embarrassing day of her life. You know, she made such a terrible mistake. And she's trying to think, what are we going to do? And she says, I got it. Let's cut the bottom third of the Sefer Torah so that it will fit into my Torah covering. And the whole village is laughing. And The Dumna Magid says, very often that's us. Instead of fitting our lives into Torah, we cut the Torah short to fit into our lives. Now the Torah is eternal, and the Torah is godly, and the Torah is truth. So the last thing that we're going to do is to start cutting things out of the Torah. That being said, the Rambam, in source number 2, in Hilchot Mamrim, really answers most of the questions. Right? We're going to have 5-6 answers. What answers most of the questions is the Rambam. Hilchot Mamrim, Perek Bet, Halacha Aleph, Beidin Gadol Shedarshu Ba'achat Min Amidot, Kefima Shenireh Be'ineihem. The job of the Beit Din HaGadol, the Sanhedrin, is to learn out and to explain the Torah Shebichtav in the way that they see fit. She'adin kach v'dinodin, and obviously they are the ones who decide. We're in source 2. Ve'amad achareim Beit Din acher, say a later Beit Din comes by, v'nireh lo tam acher listur oto, harezes soter. A later Beit Din can come and darshan the psukim differently than the first Beit Din. V'dam kafima shenireh be'inav, shenemar ela shofet asher yeh b'yamim ahem. You go by the Beit Din who is in your day. For example, Chevra, does anybody know, how do we know that men are obligated to learn Torah and women not?
It says in the Torah.
V'shinantam livanecha. And the Gemara in Masechet Kedushin says, "Livanecha v'lo livnotecha." Right? You shall teach the Torah to your sons. Your sons, doesn't say your daughters. Okay, that's
why
what.
Why do you learn Torah?
That's a separate issue. But v'igadta lebincha bayom mahu. What is that mitzvah? Sound familiar? V'higadta lebincha bayom mahu lemor bavur zeh. The mitzvah of Haggadah, to tell the story of Yitzhak Mitzrayim to your children. Where do we learn that out? You shall tell it over to your son. There Chazal say to your son and your daughter. Now where, Sarah, do you see the problem? When do Chazal decide, does a son mean son and not daughter? And when does it mean son and daughter? The answer is, they decide. And today, Bezrat Hashem, when we revive the Sanhedrin, my educated guess is that they will say, V'shinantam livanecha includes livnotecha. That today women also will be obligated to learn Torah. In other words, something which the Sanhedrin learned out from a pasuk, a later Sanhedrin can learn out and darshan the pasuk differently. Now you could say, well, what do you mean? We've been 2,000 years without a Sanhedrin. Chevra, source number 1, the Masechet Megillah, Daf Yud Zayin, tells us that we're going to have a Sanhedrin in the very near future, within our lifetimes almost definitely. How do we know? Let's look together in source number 1. The Gemara, I think we mentioned this once, tells us that when Chazal, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, set up the Shemona Esrei, they set up the order of the Brachot from the ninth Bracha on according to the order of redemption. Did we mention this once? Sound familiar? What is the ninth Bracha? Barech Aleinu. That Hashem should give rain, v'tein tal matar al pnei ha'adamah v'sabbeinu mituvah, that the land of Israel should once again flourish. That's the first sign of redemption. That the land of Israel, which used to be part of the Fertile Crescent, for 2,000 years we were told that if we sin, we're going to be sent out of the land, and the land is going to become deserted, and it was. But the Tanakh tells us that when, the Torah tells us that when we are about to come back, the land of Israel is going to give forth its fruit. That is the first sign of redemption. Umara ulomar kibbutz galuyot la'achar birkat hashanim. After the bracha for the flourishing of Eretz Yisrael, we say, tika b'shofar gadol l'cheruteinu v'sanes l'kabetz galuyoteinu. Chazal tell us that mass aliyah from the four corners of the earth, Ashkenazim, Sephardim, Jews from Yemen, Jews from Babylon, Jews from Persia, Jews from Morocco, Jews from East Europe, West Europe, Australia, South Africa, they will come back to the land of Israel. That is the second stage of Geuya Olam. Dichtiv, as it says, Ve'atem Harei Yisrael, Yechezkel Lamedvav, the Navi says, you mountains of Israel, Anpichem Titenu, grow forth your branches, Ufer Yechem Tisu, carry fruit, La'ami Yisrael ki kirvu lavo, because the nation of Israel is about to return. In other words, how do you know when Am Yisrael is about to come back to the land of Israel, Kibbutz Galiot? When first you have Birkat HaShanim, that the land of Israel becomes flourishing. Then we have Kibbutz Galiot, massive aliyah. Chevra, statisticians say that as of 2020, last year, most of the Jews in the world are in the land of Israel. That's mind-boggling. We're in historical times. I remember when the original date, Professor Sergio Della Pergola, said that it's going to be in 2030. And I said, hey, how old will I be in 2030? Hey, I'll be 70 years old. That's my lifetime, Bezrat Hashem. And then he moved up the date to 2020. Because nobody foresaw that assimilation in the Western world would be so quickly. Nobody foresaw the aliyah of the Soviet Jews, the aliyah from France, the aliyah from Ethiopia. In other words, he moved up the date, and I remember he moved up to the date about 20 years ago, and I remember telling students here that 10 years from now, statistically, is going to be the turning point. And now we are there. Now, it's sort of hard to figure out, because there are a lot of Jews, you know, who think they're Jews, and their mothers did reform or conservative conversions, and they're not really Jewish. And there are other Jews who think that they're not Jews, but they are Jews. Bikitsur, it's happening. I don't know if it was last year, this year, or next year, but that's Kibbutz Galiot. What is the next bracha on the Shemona Esrei? Anybody know Shemona Esrei by heart? Baruch Ata Hashem Mekabes Nidchei Amo Yisrael. Hashiva Shoftenu Kivarishona. What are we asking for in the Apracha? What is Shoftim?
Judges,
to revive the Sanhedrin. Girls, that is the very next stage. After we have Kibbutz Galiot, Kevan Shinit Kabzu Galiot Naase Din Barishaim Shine Emar Vashiva Shoftai Kivarishona. Sorry? Moshe Rabbeinu was the head of the Sanhedrin, he and 70 other elders. Now, how are we going to revive the Sanhedrin, Chevra? The Rambam tells us how the Sanhedrin, because you all know what's the question. The question is, smicha has stopped. You all know that the smicha the rabbis get today is not the original smicha that Moshe gave to Yoshua, and Yoshua to the Zkenim, and Zkenim to the Nevi'im. Somewhere along the line, when the Sanhedrin stopped, we don't have Dayanim who can give Dinei Nefashot anymore. So if so, how can we revive the Sanhedrin? The Rambam says, it's very simple. When the majority of the Jews in Eretz Yisrael decide on one Gadol Ador, that he is accepted on all of the different Chugim, Am Yisrael gives him Smicha. Then he, in turn, gives smicha to 70 other people. And that is how you revive the Sanhedrin. Do you know that in the time of Rav Yosef Karo, you heard of the Shulchan Aruch? The rabbis of Tzfat wanted to revive smicha. Now, if you think of it, my first reaction was, if you have three Jews, you have four opinions. How are we going to get all of the Jews to agree on one Gadol, right? If he's a chassid, the misnagdim won't want him. If he's a misnagid, the chassidim won't want him. If he's Ashkenaz, the Sephardim won't want him. If he's Sfarad, the Ashkenazim won't want him. If he's Zionist, if he's not Zionist, you know, Jews can't agree on anything. Chevra, it's a good question. How many of you have heard of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach? Right? Have you heard of Rav Moshe Feinstein?
Yeah.
Girls, they were accepted by everyone. In other words, it is true that it's going to be difficult to find somebody, but it's not impossible. I will give you a name of somebody who, I'll even tell you a secret. He is my nomination, and I'm not the only one. There is a website called Chidusha Sanhedrin, Reviving the Sanhedrin, because that's the next step. Kevin, you have to remember, if I were to ask you 150 years ago, what would you say about getting the desert of the land of Israel to flourish?
It would be impossible.
You'd say, that's impossible. And then if I were to say, how are we going to get the Jews from Yemen and from Morocco and from Russia and Poland and Ethiopia and South America, and how are we going to get them to the land of Israel? I would also have said that's impossible. Chevra, if you think of it objectively, it's a lot easier to set up a Sanhedrin than to do the first two stages. And the first two stages have already come true. Right? Now, if you go into this website, by the way, I imagine they have an English website, so you can go in. It's called, in Hebrew I know, it's called Chidusha Sanhedrin. I'll even let you in on a secret. They asked me if I was interested in being on the Sanhedrin. And I obviously said no. And I answered them that I would not want to be a member of a Sanhedrin that would have somebody like me on it.
Why?
Because that's not the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is supposed to be the top individual Rabbanim. And that is someone like Rav Asher Weiss. Have you heard of the name Rav Asher Weiss? He is accepted by everyone. Take down the name. Highlight it. Rav Asher Weiss, or Weiss in Hebrew. First of all, he's relatively young. He's in his early 60s, which means that we have a good 15 years to work on it. Number two, he's a Hasidic. He is a Tzanzer Hasid, I believe, but he's also Rosh Hashiva of a Lithuanian yeshiva. So the Misnagdim and the Hasidim like him. He is originally from North America. His mother tongue is English. So, you know, he can meet with the kings and the queens and the presidents, and he knows, you know, the modern manners, right? He's Western. He gives shiurim also to anti-Zionists, but he also gives regular shiurim in the Hesder Yeshiva in Sderot, which, by the way, is a Sephardic yeshiva, and in Machon Meir, which is a Zionist yeshiva for Balei Tshuva. In other words, he really is accepted by everyone. What we have to do is up to us, the grassroots, because he has declined, obviously. And anybody who is going to be approached and asked, will you be the head of the Sanhedrin, is obviously going to say no, right? Moshe Rabbeinu, you mentioned Moshe. He was, Vayish Moshe Anav Mad Mikol Adam Asher Pnei Adama. You have to be humble to be a Gadol Ador. But if the masses demand over and over and over and say, you are the man, and by the way, one of the issues that we mentioned before is probably going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back that's going to force us to revive a Sanhedrin. Chevra, I thought, and by the way, I'm not sure that I'm wrong, that when 1.2 million Jews came on Aliyah from the Soviet Union, and 200,000 are not halachically Jewish, right? Their father's Jewish and not their mother. What are we going to do with 200,000 goyim here? Now, there are halachic solutions. Rav Moshe Feinstein, for example, says that if you convert the children before their bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah, then they don't have to do kabbalat ol mitzvot. And we could send them to religious schools. And I've worked with Russian Olim. And many of them do send their kids to religious schools. And they undergo conversion while they're before their bar mitzvah. To convert adults en masse is more of a problem. But to convert their children, who are the ones, I mean, the older people, they're already married. To Jews, to not Jews, right? Whatever they are. But their children, those are the ones who we want to make Jewish. Right? You all see that? My educated guess, Hari, there is a halachic solution. I imagine that it will only take a Sanhedrin. Only a Sanhedrin will have the guts and the shoulders brawn enough to make such a daring change in halacha. Because what's the beauty of the Sanhedrin? They have collective responsibility. They, today, what happens is if an individual posek wants to make a change in halacha, he's always looking over his shoulder. What are they going to say? What are they going to say? Right? Who am I? Also, in terms of humility, really, who is he? On the other hand, if Am Yisrael appoints one Gadol Ador, you are the head of the Sanhedrin. You appoint another 70 people, some of them more Zionist, some of them Lubavitch, some of them Breslev, some, in other words, have a body which he appoints to get to the number of 71. Compared to the first two stages of redemption, it's not that difficult. And if so, continues the Rambam, we mentioned how to darshan psukim differently. They can do. Sanhedrin can do. Jump down to the second paragraph. This is halacha hey. Source 2, hey. V'yesh lebeit din la korav dvarim elu agzero lefisha af al pishu katan min arishonim. To make a gzera and to undo a gzera, lichatchila, the later Sanhedrin has to be greater than the previous Sanhedrin. Now, how could that be? We're not going to be greater than Hillel and Shammai and Avtalion. So how can we ever make changes? The Rambam says, the Rambam says that temporarily a Sanhedrin can delay gzerot and takanot. Kal v'chomer, for example, like kitniot, right, which makes things difficult on Pesach. What, you won't eat by my house, you won't eat by your mother-in-law, who are you going to eat by, who are you not going to eat by? Something like kitniot is very easy for the Sanhedrin to say, no, for unity of Am Yisrael, we will put that on freeze. Not only that, continues the Rambam, jump down three lines. V'chenimru l'fi sha'al l'vatel mitzvot aseh. The Sanhedrin has the power to do away with mitzvot aseh. For example, chevra, animal sacrifices. Will there be animal sacrifices in the third Beit HaMikdash or no? It's up to the Sanhedrin. Parenthetically, Rav Kook wrote an article bringing five halachic justifications that should the Sanhedrin want to do away with animal sacrifices, there are halachic ways to do it. O lavor al mitzvot lo tase, or to do away even with negative mitzvot. Kidei lachzir rabim ladat. What does that mean? Lachzir anashim ladat. The Sanhedrin can do really anything in order to bring people back to Torah. Chevra, animal sacrifices. The Sanhedrin will ask themselves, is this going to bring people closer to Torah or push them away from Torah? I don't know what's going to be, but my educated, if it were today, I think all Gedolim would agree. It's pushing people away from Torah. It's not bringing people closer to Torah. By the way, has anybody heard of Rav Avadia Yosef?
Yeah.
This is exactly the Derech Psika of Rav Avadia. Rav Avadia Yosef was the most lenient posek since the Shulchan Aruch in 500 years. And in one of his tshuvot, he was asked, why are you so lenient? How can you have the guts to disagree with so many stringent opinions and stringent customs that have been accepted? And extremely. There are a couple, there are a handful of things which he is relatively strict on.
Definitely.
Correct. Well, that's all Sfaradim. A head covering, not a wig. That's most Sfaradim, because that's from the Shulchan Aruch. That's not up to a latter-day posting. The Shulchan Aruch was Sfaradim. And that's, but by the way, here also, that's a good example. He also says that if a woman is a bala tshuva and she has trouble covering her hair, obviously it's better for her to wear a wig than not to cover her hair at all. Rav Avadia Yosef was the leader of the Shas party. Have you heard of the Shas party? At one point in Knesset, it was the third largest party in Knesset. Who is it? It's Balei Tshuva, Sephardic Balei Tshuva. And Rav Avadya Yosef said many times, the Torah is not easy for somebody who did not grow up with it. Right? Anybody hear Balei Tshuva? Right? Right? If your parents did not observe Shabbat, and to start observing Shabbat in the middle of life is difficult. To stop eating cheeseburgers, to start observing family purity. These are not easy mitzvot. So Rav Avadya Yosef said, we have to make the Torah as acceptable as we can to make sure that the masses will come back to Torah. Says the Rambam, this is the role of the Sanhedrin. And Rav Kook in Source 3 Bet, we don't have time to see it, that is exactly what they're going to do. Why? Because the Sanhedrin are going to be such learned scholars. They will be accepted by everyone. And if they are lenient, you're not allowed to be machmir. All the people who like to be machmir on this and like to be machmir on that, you are not allowed to disagree with the Sanhedrin. And also the non-religious Jews, when they see these people, and today, by the way, on television, on computer, everyone will see the genius and the tzidkut, the righteousness of these people. They will be blown away by the righteousness of these great people. And when they take the collective responsibility to say, if they decide, Shelo Asani Isha is offensive, let everyone make She'asani Kirtzono. Or let the woman say, Shelo Asani Ish, or whatever it is. They can make that change. They can do away with any mitzvah, either temporarily or permanently. Derabbanan, Aseh, Lo Taseh. They have just about unending power. By the way, somebody asked me on the website that I answer questions, Yeshivat Beit El, could there be new Sfarim added to the Tanakh? And the basic answer is no. But the bottom line is, if the Sanhedrin wants to, they can do anything. Yeah.
But if God made the Torah, and He made this what I'll say and this what I'll say, how can, the Sanhedrin, it's not even, they have, they're great people, but,
So that's what the Rambam, that's why he at the beginning of the Halachot says that you have to listen to the Shofet Asher Yeh Bayamim Ahem. Every generation has an obligation to set up, and by the way, it's not do we want to set up a Sanhedrin, it's one of the mitzvot Aseh D'Oraita is to have a Beit Din HaGadol. By the way, Rav Kook goes on to say that they don't even need smicha. As long as they are in on Harabayit, they have the halachic standing of the Sanhedrin that everybody has to listen to them. And by the way, when Rav Kook set up the chief rabbinate of Israel, and he set up the body with 23 rabbis, why 23? That's the number of the small Sanhedrin. In other words, he saw it as a foreshadowing of the new Sanhedrin. And again, Chevra, if you have yet to make Aliyah, you should focus on getting the land of Israel to flourish, focus on Tikkah b'Shofar Gadol Cheruteinu. But after you make Aliyah, if you want a project and to go down in history, just like Herzl went down into history, and Jabotinsky went down into history, because they worked on Barech Aleinu and Tikkah b'Shofar Gadol Cheruteinu, you, and by the way, it could be a woman also, to get the ball rolling. It has to be somebody who will dedicate their life to reviving the Sanhedrin. And we just said in a nutshell how to do it. Not only that, Perry, it's going to work. Because when the time is right, and the Gemara Masechet Megillah tells us this is the next stage, it is going to succeed. Let us move on. Chevra, another very important point. There are a lot of important points. We're going to continue next time, but we'll do at least one more point. Let's look together in source number 6. Rav Kook writes, "La'olam ein hamusar v'lo hadat mechuvanim ki im la'atzur et hara v'et ha'pra'ut sheba ishiyut. The goal of the Torah is to get a person to be a mensch, not to be barbaric, not to be primitive. In other words, the Torah demands only the minimum of man. If you want to add on more and more higher levels as mankind matures, that's fine, that's no problem. If you notice what Rav Kook is saying, you have to differentiate between that which the Torah allows and that which the Torah obligates. And this is connected with another point. Chevra, point number one was the real answer to updating the Torah is the Sanhedrin. And anything that they will feel is outdated or immoral, they can change. Point number two is, you know what? Boy, there's so much on this topic. What do we do first? Let me put it this way. When we look at slavery in the Torah, why did the Torah allow slavery? Chevra, what enabled Lincoln to free the slaves in America 150 years ago? That's morally, but what enabled them technically? People wanted it, but it wasn't doable until Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin. The cotton gin was a machine that picks cotton. And as soon as the Northerners could tell the Southerners to free your slaves, and they always answered, "Oh, you're big talkers, you don't have cotton." We have cotton, that's our livelihood. As soon as they could tell the Southerners, "We'll use the cotton gin, so now you can free their slaves," the God of history enabled the arrow of evolution, of moral evolution, to rise. Because when you have to remember, however, there's an important point. The Torah is eternal. Now, the Torah being eternal, usually we think from our point of view, hey, that's pretty good. The Torah is still applicable today, even though it was given 3,300 years ago. Chevra, that's pretty good. But eternal also has to go vice versa. In other words, when the Torah was given 3,300 years ago, it also had to be relevant. Did you ever think about that? Now, in a agricultural society, which is based on slave labor, if God would have said, "Thou shalt not have slaves," you know what the people would have said? This is irrelevant. Just like the Torah doesn't talk about microwaves, and doesn't talk about automobiles, and doesn't talk about surrogate mothers, because otherwise our forefathers 3,300 years ago would have said, "This isn't relevant," and would have chucked the whole thing. So the Torah said you are allowed to have slaves. Note, you're allowed but not obligated. Do you see the difference? If the economic reality obligates you to have slaves, then you are allowed to have slaves, but you have to give them the only pillow if you only have one pillow. If you have one piece of cake, it goes to the slave. You have to pay for their children's orthodontial work. You have to pay for their children's education. How do Chazal summarize the laws of slavery? Kol mi shekana eved la'atzmo, kana adon la'atzmo. When a person buys a slave, he is really buying a boss. In other words, the Torah, in order to be relevant, had to allow slavery, but didn't obligate slavery. The Torah, by the way, are shiurim these days 40 minutes or 50 minutes? 50? Okay. Chevra, another classic example. We all know that Rabbeinu Gershom, 1,000 years ago, made a takana that you're only allowed to have one wife, right? Now we look in the Tanakh and we see you're allowed to have two wives, three wives. Now if God does not like the idea of having many wives, why don't he just say, "Thou shalt not have two wives"? God knows how to prohibit things, right? He prohibits 365 things, right? So he knows he's not embarrassed to prohibit things. Why doesn't God say, "Thou shalt not have more than one wife"? Chevra, just look in the Torah. What was the scenario that just about every case where somebody had two wives in the Torah, well, why did they take the second wife? Because the first wife could not conceive. Now, in the olden days, if your wife couldn't conceive, then you don't have children, you don't have anyone to support you when you retire. Right? In an agricultural society, at the age of 60, when you start having back problems, right, and there's no social security, who's going to support you? Kids are going to support you, but if you don't have kids, there's really no solution. The Torah had to allow taking a second wife, even though the Torah doesn't suggest it. Does anybody remember what Chana and Penina were called? Chana and Penina?
No, but Penina was his second wife.
They were called Tsarot. What does Tsaros mean?
Pain.
Pain, trouble. Anybody who takes a second wife is just asking for trouble. When the first wife cannot conceive, so you took a second wife to have children. She has the firstborn. And then your first wife, that's the Parshan Ki Tetze, your first wife then conceives. The Torah says, don't take the Bechorah from the wife that you don't like and give it to the son of the wife that you do like. Why would you have thought, what does that mean, take a wife that you don't like? Who has a wife that they don't like? Now you understand. Why did Shmuel's father Elkanah, he loved Chana, married Chana, didn't have children, he took Penina. And that was the problem. And the same thing, whenever there are two wives, Kal v'chomer three or four, it is because they couldn't conceive. Now, before there were surrogate mothers, before there's artificial insemination, and if there's no social security, how are you supposed to support yourself when you're older? You're up the creek without a paddle. And therefore, the Torah had to allow, in the olden days, had to allow a person to take two wives. What do you want to say? Well, that was modern science. They thought that it was old science.
For example, let's say a man married five girls,
so he can get pregnant. But there was no such concept anywhere where a woman has two husbands. It just wasn't around.
No, I'm not just saying that. Like, let's say a man,
obviously, it's a good question. But that wasn't done anywhere, so why should the Torah allow something that even the primitive world didn't allow? Yeah?
What did you say before that's allowed but not obligated? What is it?
Because the Torah, when need be, allows you to take a second wife, but doesn't obligate it. When need be, you need to take a slave in the olden times. The Torah allowed it, but didn't obligate it.
So, like, now you wouldn't be able to marry a second wife or have a slave because it's not necessary?
Correct. And that, by the way, regarding a second wife, it's already 1,000 years that you're not allowed to take a second wife. Sfaradim, Yemenites, did take second wives. And when they came in Aliyah in Tashach in 1948, the chief rabbinate, Rav Herzog and Rav Uziel, made a takana that Yemenites who had a second wife didn't have to divorce them. You know, that's obviously a drastic stage. But you're not allowed anymore to take a second wife. In other words, today, where modern science has changed, the Torah has no problem updating itself, especially if it wasn't obligated in the first place. It was just allowed. Do you all see the difference?
Yeah.
If something was allowed, but you don't need it anymore, so just don't do it. We will continue next time because there are a lot more important points. Make sure